Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. How are you doing, my friends? Thanks for your emails and messages of encouragement these past couple weeks. It's been nice to hear from you. It's been a real wake-up for me to have been forced to close my office of my practice here for the past 7 weeks. You know, it's work that's kept me motivated and inspired for 22 years, so I'm trying to figure out my place again. And luckily, the podcast has kept me quite busy and engaged, and I'm happy to have this. But, you know, it's a good time to sit, I think, in gratitude for myself for having been able to do the meaningful work that I feel like I've been able to do for so long. And I do look forward to getting back to that work soon and see some of you. I've gone through a whole range of emotions through this experience, and gratitude is the nicest of them. But I've tried to stay as nonpartisan as possible here on the podcast, and I intend to continue to. That being said, when leadership fails, it's important to not just complain, but to search for and offer solutions. That's what it means to take leadership. And I'm happy to have Sarah Berliner of Vote Like a Mother here on the podcast to speak to us about the leadership role that she has taken in supporting the caretakers of the world over the past couple of years and through this pandemic. She's created a call for joyful activism through her nonprofit, Vote Like a Mother. And she'll be up in just a minute. If this is your first time listening to the show, I want to welcome you. Highway to Health is a place for you to explore and create your own blueprint for health. Having worked in integrative health for more than 20 years, I'm acutely aware of how all aspects of our lives come to have an effect on our overall state of being. And it is my hope that through the content and conversations you get here, you'll be more engaged and empowered, both personally and in your communities. And I want to give a big shout out to the new supporters of the podcast. Your dollars are helping us build more resources and a whole community of health support. If you'd like to become a supporter of the podcast, there are a couple of ways. One is financial. You can support the show for as little as $1 a month by going to patreon.com/highwaytohealth. Or you can click the link in the show notes on the app that you're listening on and become a supporter right now. The other is by sharing the content that we create to help more people become aware of Highway to Health and the resource that we provide. And if you're a health professional or involved in a health-related project, you can also connect with me on LinkedIn or through the contact page on our new website, highway2.health, so that I'm aware of the work that you're doing. And I'd love to bring you into this community of health improvement influencers. I'm so happy to share this conversation with you today that I had with Sarah Berliner. We recorded this in person together back in early March in New York, just a week or so before social distancing was put into place. I've known Sarah for over a decade and have been able to witness her work in children's media and education, and she's been a real inspiration to me for her activism and resolve in supporting the causes that she's championed. She's the founder of Vote Like a Mother, a nonprofit started to support the caretakers of the world and to activate people to exercise the power of their vote for the people who are working in our best interest. I held this episode for a couple of months to address the concerns I saw arising with the coronavirus, but it hasn't aged a bit. In fact, it feels even more important today, especially as we come upon the summer before this presidential election year. Some important reminders in this one. Please enjoy my conversation with Sarah Berliner. The cool thing is that you found a real niche with your, you know, desire to be an activist and your family's history of being activists. That's a really cool thing to have just found. And I feel the same way with the podcast right now and just everything around this view I'm taking on health too, and getting and just engaging that dialogue that I feel like it's there. It was already kind of there, and then we both kind of found things that just amped it up a little bit.
And brought a specific lens to it. Yeah. I mean, I like the lens as a metaphor because I like the idea of being able to really focus in on something.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're doing, and absolutely how I've thought about Vote Like a Mother, that parenthood and the act of mothering, not necessarily being a mother or being a parent, but the act of caretaking, the act of thinking about someone other than yourself in the way that you move in the world, that is the lens that I think needs to be applied to politics, because there's so much greed and selfishness and people voting in their own interest, even if they aren't actually voting in their interest, but they've been brainwashed to believe that they are, and to believe that this sort of greed is good. You know, I mean, that crops up, I don't know, is it every few decades, or there are these periods in American history where every person for themselves, and of course, it usually is every man for himself, you know, becomes the ethos of the day. And I think it is up to those of us that don't want to live that way to fight as hard against it as we can.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And I feel like right now in particular, we're going through it again. I mean, I just had this conversation with my son who, you know, we brought the kids to the voting booth with us, and you know, his take on things right now is that Elizabeth Warren, you know, for him in his mind, was just Hillary part two. Oh. and only because he doesn't want to see the president reelected. Mm. Right, but it's very easy to, like, that's and this is the sort of like subtle misogyny that, not that he doesn't, you know, like women, or he's not in that mindset or anything. It's just that's how the institutionalized aspect of these things start to play into everything. And so it was interesting. I was like, because I knew I was going to talk to you, I was like in this mindset too of just thinking about, because we had to have some conversations with him about, you know, that way of thinking about things, because he's old enough to have that conversation at this point. We felt like we had to say something, but you know, then start say, do you understand how challenging though it must be to be a woman trying to get into this space, and why there still has not been a female president? And so it's a good thing to have a dialogue about, and I feel like For what you created, and this is one of the things that I love about Vote Like a Mother, is that it's not partisan in any sort of way, and it's multi-generational, and you can open up a huge dialogue with a little phrase like that.
That's absolutely the intention, and what I've found is that kids and young adults around Phoenix's age and older connect with this phrase. In part, they really like the double entendre, right? The right. Vote like a mother.
Yeah.
They get it. They get that it's intentional. Then it makes them laugh. And humor drives so much when you're young, right? And it should drive so much for us when we're grown-ups too. But I have found at events that I've done, and I'm starting to see it on social media as well, that youth really get it, and they also use it to spark conversations with their parents. And guess what? We need the youth vote. We really need their parents to vote. Mm-hmm. And so, honestly, if especially white suburban voters can be turned out, can be swayed, can be motivated to re-engage with politics because they've become disillusioned, they're apathetic, they are disgusted by politics generally, mm-hmm. we need them back in the voting booth. And I believe that a way to get them there is for the conversation to be started with their kids.
Yeah.
And there are families, I think, that like mine, that politics was something that was discussed. And if I had questions, they got answered to the best of my parents' ability. And those kinds of who believes in what discussions were not off the table. There are a lot of families where that is not the case.
Yeah.
And I think the children of those families are getting activated, and they're getting activated in a way where they see their rights being affected. They see their friends' rights being affected. Even if they come from privilege, they probably, because of the generational trends about sort of demographics overlapping and talking to each other and the age of social media,
wokeness,
right? They're more aware.
Yeah.
And so if the kids with privilege can have a conversation over this funny slogan.
Right.
And what does that mean to you? Or do you vote? And start asking questions of their parents. That to me is a way in. I have one example that happened this fall that was the sort of the moment when this crystallized for me. I sold a shirt to among hundreds of shirts I sold at events and fundraisers where I, you know, donate 100% of the profits. This fall, ahead of the off-year election, right? It wasn't the midterms. It wasn't a presidential year. It was between. And so there were local elections. There were state level. There were county level elections in, I think, almost every state, if not every state. And the day after the November election, so this would have been November 6th of 2019, I got a photo of a white woman. She looked like a woman anyway, and she, she looked like a mom, and she looked like she was probably in her 50s. And she was very proudly wearing a Vote Like a Mother shirt, and she had put an I Voted sticker on it. And she was outside a building. You couldn't really tell what it was, but it was a selfie. And the note that came with it was, "This is my mom. She's usually not engaged. She lives in Virginia. And she took the selfie at her polling place yesterday, November 5th, 2019, when Virginia, the state legislature was flipped and became the last state needed to ratify the ERA. Gun legislation has been considered, and all sorts of things that were had been in motion but been stymied by a legislature that was, more interested in getting themselves reelected, supporting gun manufacturers, et cetera. They had put a hold on a lot of really important stuff. And this mom was part of that change. And I feel very honored to think that possibly her pride in wearing her Vote Like a Mother shirt and the dialogue that was opened with her daughter who had sent her the shirt would have maybe played some small part in motivating her to get to the polls when she typically wouldn't.
And this is just the beginning. Like this is what I'm kind of like interested in too, is that this is a newer thing for you, having worked in like children's products and apps and entertainment and stuff. There's always a part of you thinking about things from this developmental standpoint. So now you're kind of like going to the, you know, the parents of the children, basically, that, you know, I love to kind of dig in as I'm thinking about, you know, my guests, and I just happen to know you a little better than most of my guests. Sure. But just to sort of see the trends and the way that your development has sort of happened through all this, it seems like a perfect thing, you know, to have come from you, and that it was sort of accidental because, right, this was like a quick sign that you had made for one of the women's marches, right?
It was actually for the March for Our Lives.
Oh, the March. That's right.
Started by the Parkland teen survivors.
Which was when?
It was 5 weeks. 5 weeks after Parkland. It was late March of 2018.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was me and my Sharpie and a piece of cardboard just spitballing, vote them out. You know, what is the gun violence issue boil down to? Of course, electing people who care about protecting children's lives.
Yeah.
Vote them out. Vote like your life depends on it. Vote like a mother. That's pretty good. I haven't seen that, but I'm probably the 1,000th person to think of that. So I put my sign to the side, and you know, the next morning we went in to the march, the New York City version of it, and it was really like nothing I've ever seen before in terms of the response to this sign. New Yorkers were crossing subway cars to come take a photo of it. I mean, if you can get a New Yorker to cross a subway car for any reason, you know, usually it means like, honestly, someone threw up, right?
Right.
They have to be very motivated.
Something smelly on them.
Yeah. So I knew within the first few minutes of stepping onto the subway that I had something that was different and that was resonating with people. So I got on the subway Wi-Fi and Googled it, and it wasn't out there.
Yeah.
And so I got on, you know, web URL purchasing site and got votelikeamother.org, and I went on the social media sites and got the handles and tried to get the Twitter handle, but the Wi-Fi stopped working, and then I couldn't get data out because we were in this crowd of hundreds of thousands of people in the streets by then. And I called my mom because I could get a call out, and I was like, "Mom, have you ever used Twitter? I need you to get me a Twitter account."
Have you ever done this for anything for yourself for
never,
a project before?
Never.
Yeah, that's amazing when you just like feel so moved by something.
Yeah, I had started something with a college friend the day after Trump was elected in a sort of fit of what can we do, which I sort of now see as my initial attempt to really act on this idea of we all should be contributing in the best way that we can. Mm-hmm. So we had started a Facebook page called Don't Give Up, Gift Up. And it was about all of the nonprofits that were going to really need our help, from Planned Parenthood to organizations that would provide legal assistance to immigrants, you know, to people applying for asylum, to, you know, all sorts of different organizations devoted to racial justice and civil rights, healthcare. And it didn't really go anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, having a Facebook page where we were just referring people to organizations was useful kind of for a few minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and then there were bigger fish to fry. And I feel like that's a very Midwestern expression that you probably get, but I don't know if everyone will.
Should I talk about hot dish?
Exactly.
Casserole.
Pass the jello. And so when I had this idea that people were responding to in this very passionate way, and, you know, walking out of cafes to take a photo after the March for Our Lives, I realized, you know, this is the thing. This is my moment. The universe has smiled on me with a great idea.
Yeah.
And I need to do what I'm good at.
And it's and you kind of already put it out there. I mean, when it seems like with what you were, just that motivation was already present a little bit right after the election. But knowing a little bit of your past too. So when did activism start for you? You have a very special family member who I know was very active.
It's true. It's true. My grandmother, Leah Silver Berliner. Just an amazing woman, lived to almost 101 and was just a fighter, you know, her entire life. And grew up in a religious family that was pretty cloistered and chauvinistic, mm-hmm. and had different rules and abilities, you know, bestowed on you depending on your gender. And she didn't think it was right. And she married someone who grew up quite secular. And uh-huh. they decided that they would live their lives as they felt, you know, was right and true.
Yeah.
And that is really what they did. My grandfather's contribution was primarily on the side of being a naturalist and being a scientist. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of kidney research that he is sort of responsible for originating and made a lot of discoveries that have saved lives and improved lives. Mm. But my grandmother's was much more on the social activism side. Yeah. And she was a top volunteer leader within Girl Scouts throughout most of her life. She was with Planned Parenthood of Connecticut in the 70s and 80s, and started a fund to provide money to poor and working class women who couldn't afford abortions. And she just was, you know, my inspiration for using your privilege, right? She was a white lady married to a white guy with a good government and then university job.
Yeah.
And she could afford to not work for pay. She raised four kids who are all contributing members of society in different ways, and educators and doctors and community participants. And she just remained that kind of person.
Yeah.
And was, you know, the first to organize people to go to D.C. for a march. And you know, now we're kind of in generation four with our kids following in those footsteps.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Is that your father's mother?
Mm-hmm.
So is that what led him into law?
You know, that's a great question. I've never asked him.
Huh.
I've never asked him that question. His work in law has been primarily in the private sector. But he became, probably 15 years ago, he became a mediator. And I don't know. I've kind of wondered, you know, what was that shift about? Certainly mediation can happen in the private sector, but it's a very different approach. It is not about fighting, you know, down to the bone to get what you want. That wasn't really ever what he did. He was more of a deal maker and, you know, kind of in real estate and corporate law and, you know, companies buying companies or buying property, that kind of stuff. And he did some real estate development, but then,
was that all in Chicago?
That was all in Chicago.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the work, you know, especially when he was working for other people and business those would and happen in other places. Yeah. But all based in Chicago where I grew up. But yeah, he became a mediator and he does a lot of work with families that need mediation around business, around money. He's able to have hard conversations with people that typically have not had hard conversations within their family. And he's always been very involved in the committee on the, you know, board of hospitals or the, you know, head of a community center, you know, raising money for politicians. I mean, he always laughs when we talk about Barack Obama. He was an early supporter because he had friends involved in Democratic politics in Illinois who said, this guy's going far.
Mm-hmm.
And they were inviting my dad to early Obama fundraisers when he was running for, you know, state Senate.
Yeah, I remember seeing in your house, a very young Barack Obama picture with your dad.
Yeah, right. All the gray hair was on my dad, none on Barack. And I got to shake his hand and my brother had interned for him and, you know, he didn't spend a lot of time with him.
He was
a candidate, but he knew who my brother was and was so gracious. And so my dad always talks about how Barack Obama is the only politician who has ever called him on his cell phone to ask for a donation.
Hmm.
But, you know, that's a pretty old story at this point. Now, one has anything but their cell phone. So if a politician's going to call you, they're going to call your cell phone. But it shows how old fashioned my dad is.
Yeah. So your activism roots are pretty deep when it comes right down to it. So it's one thing I really appreciate about the way that you kind of go through things is and I struggle with this for myself. I mean, I've given money. I have done some event type things, but it's like I just watching you. You always seem to like have this sense that like this is something I have to go do today. You know, it's not like an option. And this is one of the things I wanted to talk to you about because I feel like there is a struggle that I recognize it in myself, and I also feel like this crosses over into some other areas that this is not just about activism, but about change that you want to see happen and having something that really sort of engages you and being able to sort of channel that energy. And sometimes it comes from a trigger or from something that's really affected you. You know, anyone who's probably been involved in the Parkland stuff now, they're all in on that for probably the rest of their lives. The challenging part about some of this, though, I find, and I'm interested in hearing your experience now, since Vote Like a Mother has been a much bigger part of your life in terms of how much energy and time you're putting into it and money, and it's that balance of putting your energy into something, but not. You know, not to the point that you start to wear yourself down, or the stresses of the triggers of the things that are sort of like really firing you up start to work against you, like trying to figure out what that balance is. And with so many things out there that you feel like you want to have some effect on, where do you even start sometimes?
It's difficult. I mean, I don't have any great answers. I wish that I did. I think that if they were out there, I probably would have them by now.
Yeah. Well, what have you learned from Vote Like a Mother? I mean, this is. I'm guessing this is the most public facing thing that you've done in your career.
By far.
Yeah. And just that there's a part of this that's always you're willing to kind of sacrifice and put yourself out there, but for the first time, you're having to like put your opinion and your face to all this stuff. I mean, I'm going through it a little bit on myself, and I think that the first part of that is dealing with your ego to some extent. You know, you have to kind of like figure out your why in this, and how much of, you know, people's perception of you you're willing to let go of. Once you can get past that, there's still with the social media landscape and the news feeds and everything, it's just a constant barrage to weed through. So what do you do in terms of that balance?
I would say that I say no.
Yeah.
Right? I think that is actually kind of like the place where you have to start. Is an acknowledgement that you cannot do everything. Right. You cannot care about every issue, and you cannot work on every problem, and you cannot come up with every solution. Just not going to happen.
Yeah.
So if you start from a place of narrowing, you get down to what do I really care about?
Yeah.
And then you look for like-minded people, and you look for organizations that can prove their effectiveness. I'm really big on local community involvement as a way to have an outsized impact relative to sort of what you have to give. Yeah. Most people are not going to go out there and develop a national platform for themselves. It's just not the way that most people want to live their life.
It's also very expensive.
It's expensive. It's hard. It is, as you said, a big hit to the ego. Mm-hmm. You have to get over a lot of stuff. And it takes up a ton of time.
Yeah.
There are lots of reasons not to do that. But the good thing is that actually you can have a bigger impact by getting involved at the local and community level, and that is real impact. We cannot discount that. People get very engaged with the presidential cycle. Mm-hmm. It's our figurehead. It is a manifestation of the culture of celebrity. It mm-hmm. is cult of personality.
Yeah.
All these things that are ever present in American culture, writ large on the national stage. And yes, it matters. I don't want to discount that.
Yeah.
But what also matters, and where you can actually have a bigger impact on a day-to-day basis, is in your community.
Yeah.
And that's on a range of issues. And there are things that you can work on that actually have a bigger impact on you and your family and the people that you love.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I started. And I got a little bit involved in, you know, sort of local politics where I live, started kind of moving out from there, sort of the next concentric circle. Mm-hmm. And then the people that supported me at the local and sort of extra community level, then were the people that amplified what I was doing to people they knew outside of those circles. And it just kind of became this thing where it would follow on and started to get awareness all over the place. I think that deciding what are the things that you feel the most passionate about, that is that sort of narrowing down is a relief. And I do feel like I have to maintain more knowledge than other people because I just, you know, people ask me about stuff or, you know, I want to be informed. I don't want to kind of have, you know, not have an opinion on things. I don't ever claim to have any answers. Yeah. Right?
But you have to have an opinion.
I have to have an opinion. It doesn't necessarily mean I have to have an opinion expressed or like an endorsing of candidates, but on issues, absolutely have to know where I stand.
Yeah.
And then I can talk to people about what I believe about the issues, and then they can go do the homework with resources that I'm happy to provide them to match up who are the candidates who would actually move things in the right direction if I agree with what Sarah's saying. Who would move things in the right direction. And, you know, if there aren't those people that maybe, you know, I have to run. And that's a big part of what I want to also encourage people to do is to realize that people who run start somewhere. And often they do start in terms in community leadership. They started on a school board or the city councilor in their town or, you know, a county role. So I really want people to understand that most of the times they don't lack things that elected legislators have.
You're right.
These are all people that come from somewhere and started with a limited amount of information, got schooled in whatever way worked for them, and went, you know, on to start a campaign. And there are lots of organizations that help first-time candidates and even help people decide whether they should become a first-time candidate.
Yeah. And doing the local part also is about face-to-face. And it's not like hurling things at each other through social media where, you know, you have this, you know, facade that's keeping you apart. You actually have to address someone eye to eye and have those conversations. And a lot of times you also get from that exchange support and, you know, praise or pushing forward for the thing that you're working on. So it's an important thing. I thought about this a lot. I listened to a podcast about starting podcasts when I was first, you know, thinking about doing it. And it was somebody who has I don't want to use the name, but it was somebody who has a pretty famous podcast at this point. And he said he started it basically to influence the 100 influencers that he thought were the most important people. And they were mostly people in his, you know, in his sphere. Either he knew them or had connections of them. And that he knew that by at least influencing those people, he could have some kind of change happen. And so I thought about that a lot from the beginning of my, you know, starting this was first I had to figure out my why and then really thinking about those 100 people. And I, you know, now that I write things for the podcast and I think about who those people are. And the thing is, I know a lot of the people who are actually listening at this point too. So it makes it easier. But there is something that grows out of that because there are some influencers within that crowd that then start to say, this is a really important conversation. I want to share this with some people. And, you know, people start to kind of step to you as a voice of reason or somebody who's just putting the effort in, if nothing else.
Yeah. And I think that we're in a time when we all want to find what's good. And by what's good, I don't mean like, you know, high quality.
Yeah.
I mean, actually like good and from the heart and contributing to the world because there's so much garbage out there. And when people sense that your aim is true and that you can be helpful to people, I think they do want to evangelize for that. Yeah. And so reaching those people, it's really important. And, you know, those are your sort of first line folks who are going to validate what you're doing, They're going to encourage you to keep going, and they're also going to amplify it.
Are people coming to you saying, how do I vote like a mother? Is that a question that you're getting? I think it's on your website possibly, or you have something.
Yeah, I've written about what it means to vote like a mother. Mm-hmm. But I really feel strongly that it means something different to every person.
And can men vote like a mother?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I really feel that voting like a mother does not mean that you have to be a mother.
Yeah.
At the same time, we all come from mothers.
Yeah.
There's not a human among us who hasn't. And also, we all mother something or someone, mm-hmm. whether it is actual kids that came to you by any of the ways that one can have kids, yeah. and be a literal parent. There's also nieces and nephews. There are grandkids. There are pets. There are plants. There's the earth. There are parents. Sometimes we have to mother our parents.
Right.
You know, we take care of our friends. I think of it as a verb, mm-hmm. you know, more than a noun.
Yeah.
And I really believe that it is about a perspective of caretaking, of empathy, of kindness, mm-hmm. rather than a role and yeah. something that has a strict definition. Yeah. I feel that it's very, very fluid.
Yeah. And at a time when I think it's important to think about the fact that, you know, there is a change going on in the way that, I mean, I see it with through the conversations I have with my teenager, that there are ways of thinking about the way that we sort of live in society together. Gender fluidity is becoming a much more of a norm in the way that we don't think about things culturally from that same place. And I would say that even the way that parenting is being done right now is being done in a different style. We've got a ways to go, but if I'm any example right now, I mean, I'm really the flex parent who ends up doing a lot of the mothering, and it's something that I think I'm quite capable of in some ways, but I still at times get sort of stuck in a mindset of like, wait, this is not my role. You know, mm-hmm. when I'm you know, carting around to every single thing, and because I have a wife who's in a corporate gig, you know, so those kinds of things I think our culture is just changing very rapidly in the way that we sort of like identify ourselves at this point too.
I think that's true, and I think that anything that we can do to promote that shift, mm-hmm. Whether it is modeling that and sharing that story out. I mean, you talking about that on your podcast is a great example, you know, for people to be able to see it and know that it's safe. It's a safe choice to make, to know that there are other people that they trust who are living their lives that way, and to know that it's also okay to have the two steps forward, one step back, where you think you're really evolved and progressive, and to then stop for a second and question what you're doing, because our minds have pathways that are well worn from being trained from an early age as to gender roles.
Yeah. I mean, and that even goes for political conversation. I think I'm finding, at least with Phoenix right now, that he, you know, he has a certain lean to the way that he thinks about things, but he really thinks about things for the most part in how can problems be solved, how can people live together better. And you know, he leans towards, you know, in terms of his, where he gets his news, obviously he's going to get it from news feeds, but you know, people who are infusing comedy with it a lot of times. And he really, you know, he really wants to have like a real discourse go on. So if he feels we lean too much in one direction, he's like, come on, you know? And he really wants to challenge that. Sometimes it's a little over the top, because that's just what ends up happening a lot of times. It's him learning how to sort of engage in this discourse. But a lot of times he's right. Like a lot of times I can see the way that like I'm not staying open enough to a certain viewpoint. So our kids can teach us quite a bit, actually.
I think that's true. I think they have sensors for dogma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's great. I mean, I feel very privileged to have grown up in a school and a place and a time surrounded by people that were okay with kids questioning things. Mm-hmm. But I think that a lot of our generation did not have that and yeah. came to it later. And so I think that we are raising kids that are more like in a way getting that I got early. They're also getting that early.
Yeah.
They're challenging authority. They're asking questions. They're not accepting everything that is delivered to them in terms of ways of thinking and ways of, you know, voting and acting in the world. I am all for that. And if that can be if that can be a silver lining in terms of the evil parts of social media, if that ends up being one of the great things about social media, is that kids get that modeling, see that there is not only one way of living, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, I do think it's, I mean, I think kind of what's going on right now, there's in terms of the what's going on politically in the world and the way that we're relating to one another is coming from this big shift that's going on that our interconnectedness has created through these social media platforms. But it's hard to tell at this point whether or not that's going to win out over the infusion of you know the fake you know things that are going on within social media too. And I feel lucky that at one point I remember having this conversation with Phoenix when he was maybe like 8-9 years old, where he was watching something on TV. It might have been the news or something. He would get up early sometimes and watch like the morning news.
Really?
Yeah. And then he would come at me and say, you know, something that he heard basically. It's sort of like, you know, just the most dramatic version of it because it's the way the news is presenting it. And I would say, well, where did you hear this? You know, what's your source? So anytime that he would sort of like throw out something, some rhetorical thing to me, I would always say, well, what's your source? So now I see him doing the same thing. You know, he's really kind of, and he's challenging me in the same way.
So great.
So
that's fantastic. I think that having those conversations with our kids and involving them in decision making and sort of research to form opinions. I mean, I just think that's invaluable. I mean, what a gift you're giving him.
Yeah.
I'm really a fan of family activism as an extension of that. So you have the conversations. How do you get involved together and have what I call joyful activism, cross-generational joyful activism.
Yeah.
You don't want to do stuff with your kids that you don't want to do stuff with your kids that's sad and depressing and sort of, you know, mourning all the time, which some activism does have that kind of as its baseline and a performative aspect that is powerful, but certainly will bring you down.
Yeah.
And I think is absolutely a necessary part of the grown-up activism landscape. But I think with kids, there are a lot of opportunities to do things that make them feel like they're going to have a difference and knowing that they will actually have an impact, but also is a chance for those discussions to just become a part of the sort of living, breathing family life that you have together. So some examples might be writing postcards, writing op-eds, you know, writing letters to the editor for your local paper.
Yeah.
There's having bake sales and lemonade stands to raise money for candidates, for nonprofits, for advocacy organizations. There are a lot of those kinds of things, whether it's raising money or connecting with voters, I mean, we went and door knocked in 2016 in October in Pennsylvania with our kids, and we still talk about that experience. Mm-hmm. And it was hard. It was hard mostly because we had a three-year-old. Not even three. Yeah. was a few weeks away from being three. And we had a 7-year-old. And, you know, the little legs get tired and they want snacks all the time. Yeah. They're thirsty and all this sort of stuff. But once we were committed to doing it and we were well prepared, it actually was a fantastic opportunity for them to talk to people. And honestly, there were a lot of people there that had not been visited by door knockers, and they wanted to have a conversation, and they were so happy to see kids engaged.
Yeah, I could see that.
It was amazing. The energy that we got out of it was, I think, just as effective as whatever moving we did of people to, you know, get them to the polls.
Yeah. And with older kids too. I mean, I just read this article about Greta, and when she was going through such a struggle in probably middle school, and, you know, was being bullied and was having a lot of troubles, you know, a lot of mental health issues, but also learning challenges, and that her this thing that she just became so passionate about, which was really bringing her down, her parents decided to really engage with, rather than say, you know, that's not where our focus should be right now, you need to feel better. They just said, this is kind of a great distraction for you right now. Let's throw energy into that, and we will support whatever you want to do with that. And I think that's an amazing, you know, lesson for us as parents. I mean, I also read this last week, so knowing that I was going to come talk to you, I was just thinking about, you know, one of the conversations that you and I had was just how, you know, it's very easy to get addicted and pulled into the news feeds and feel like, you know, with the coronavirus and with the elections and whatever the state of the world is with the economy or the environment, that you can just start to feel every article you read starts to make you, you know, feel like there's nothing you can do to stop this. I'm wondering if you have something that do you pull yourself away from news feeds once in a while to just focus on something? Because I had this experience this summer where I went to Iceland and I didn't have reception a lot of the time because much of the island just didn't have it, and I just kind of got lost interest in whatever was going on in the rest of the world, and I got out of that at just such a renewed sense of like, oh, this is what's important in life again. And it's so easy to get pulled out of that.
It's very easy, and things are designed so that you don't get that break.
Right.
They're designed to be addictive.
Yeah.
And I mean both the tools, which of course we think of them as tools, but they're actually like for-profit products that we use. They're mm-hmm. not really tools. So I mean, yeah. We may use them as tools, but, you know, Facebook makes a ton of money. Twitter makes a ton of money. That's their goal.
Yeah.
Those things are designed to be addictive. And people like Trump have figured out how to use the addictive nature of those products to their advantage. And they create addictive content. Mm-hmm. For those products.
Yeah.
So what happens is everyone is just waiting to be outraged at his latest tweet. And that just gets him more attention and it gets his followers riled up. And it's a constant cycle. And it's very debilitating. It's totally not healthy for us as a society.
But from a neurochemical standpoint, it's what continuously fires. I mean, it is the way that any food, alcohol, drug addiction works. It's the same mechanism basically in the brain.
Right. Hits the same receptors.
Yeah.
Yeah. I believe it. And so, you know, I mean, I think cable news kind of figured it out first. And mm-hmm. then the politicians followed and the products followed, the tech products followed. And it is a hot mess. It's really, I think it's just something that we have to all try to break our own addictions to and try to make sure that our kids don't develop those addictions. Because yeah. I think that would be just even worse than, if, you know, I mean, we may be too far gone, but if we can save our kids.
Yeah. I mean, but I do think people can make little changes. I mean, I got certain apps off my phone that I just felt were a distraction and it took me out of my flow. Those are simple things that I think we can do. And then I think sometimes just organizing when during the day you allow yourself. I mean, I do this with like my emailing. I think people get used to the fact that I don't respond to my emails, you know, I might respond to them in the morning and I'll respond to them at the end of my day. If not, I'll get back to them the next morning. I mean, I think you just have to kind of get yourself, and you know, when I was starting my business, I had, you know, partners that I had to, you know, tell them, I don't want to receive anything that's triggering after 7 o'clock. I want to have that break mentally. But I think we can kind of do the same kinds of things for ourselves just in the way that we sort of go about trying to get information from what's going on politically or the projects that we have are passionate about and have decided to become engaged with.
I agree. And I think that we all honestly have to prioritize sleep.
Yeah.
I feel really strongly about that.
Yeah.
One of my good friends is a sleep researcher at in the public health arena. She's a tenured professor at a medical school in New York, and the research that she's done about device use and its connection to poor quality sleep and to performance, it's plain as day.
Yeah.
The data does not lie.
Yeah.
And I think that we all need to be shutting our devices off longer before we go to bed, and we need to not touch them until the morning. No waking up and pulling your phone off of your nightstand. And I think if we could all be really good about that, we would all be doing a service, not just to ourselves, but to everyone that we're in contact with.
Absolutely. I mean, we're trying to keep a certain amount of energy for these things that we want to, you know, engage with and work on improving in our lives. Without the energy and the sleep and just the drain that technology has, I think, on our systems, you know, when we're in that all day long, and especially into the evening hours when that blue light is affecting our brains and keeping us sort of turned on in some ways, with so we're not hitting those deep levels of sleep. That Matthew Walker book about why we sleep, highly recommend. I've talked about it on the podcast before. It's a lot of the sleep research. It's like 30 years of sleep research. And it's a fascinating read. It's done well. He's British, and there's some humor infused into it, and just great sort of storytelling and examples of things in there. So that's a good one for anyone who's trying to, you know, get their head around their own sleep project. I wanted to mention quickly your website, votelikeamother.org. And I noticed that you have there's a tab in there that I think has a bunch of for anyone who's kind of trying to figure out a place to go or where to start with an organization. You have a lot of things listed. I don't remember which tab it was, but there's it's a great place to kind of come and start, you know, trying to figure out something for yourself if you're looking.
Yeah, and they tend to be nonprofits that I support with Vote Like a Mother and organizations that are working on some aspect of improving lives for families in the U.S.
Yeah.
They tend to be mom-led or mom-centered because they tend to be the last people to be supported in terms of giving and in terms of volunteerism. So, yeah, I mean, what I always say is, there are opportunities for you to contribute no matter whether you have 5 days a week or just 5 minutes a day.
Yeah.
And the organizations I have listed there are places that I've vetted, that I know their impact and that I feel really great about sending people there, whether it's just to amplify what they're doing on social media, whether it's to give them money, whether it's to volunteer for them, which oftentimes you can do in person or online. And then, you know, to look at who they're supporting. If they're nonprofits that are registered in such a way that they can do actually candidate advocacy, you know, to look at who they're supporting. And oftentimes you'll find candidates on lots of different levels. So from the local all the way up to, you know, the federal level.
Yeah. And I also want to make a plug for your gear. So 100% of the profits from your gear are going to some, you've chosen some of these nonprofits to fund, correct?
That's right. And so the profits from website sales, and the website, by the way, is votelikeamother.org. And so, yes, I donate 100% of the profits on the gear to these nonprofits that I think are essential.
Yeah.
And I do events. You know, if there's a candidate that I feel, you know, particularly needs support, you know, I'll do an event and donate the profits on everything at that fundraiser.
Oh, cool.
You know, I do some wholesale or sort of collaborative projects. And so, you know, any candidates that want to get in touch with me or someone that's volunteering on a campaign and they feel that the gear would be useful and their worldview aligns with what I think will, you know, do the most good for the most people, can feel free to get in touch with me. And my, you know, my Instagram is the place where I spend the most time in terms of the content. So for anybody that wants to get a better sense of what I'm doing out in the world, what's happening, you know, some things that are interesting and relate to the idea of Vote Like a Mother, on Instagram, it's just at Vote Like a Mother.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm on Twitter. I don't use it very much. And I'm on Facebook. I also don't use it very much, although I tend to share more news and informative stuff on Facebook. And on Facebook, it's at Go Vote Like a Mother.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this, Sarah.
That's, I am so delighted.
Great. I'm really proud of this project, and I just wanted to make sure more people knew about you too.
Thank you. I love your podcast, and I'm a regular listener. Oh, not just because you're my friend.
Thanks, Sarah. Sarah Berliner, folks. Hope this inspires you to get out there and support the people, organizations, and leaders who are looking out for our best interests. Just a reminder that Vote Like a Mother is donating the profits of face masks right now to Feeding America. It's a great way to support Sarah's work and to remind people in your community to vote, possibly even engage this conversation by simply wearing a mask. That also tells the frontline workers in our shops, stores, and health systems that we're looking out for you too. It also supports an organization that is putting a lot of effort into feeding those in our communities who are struggling the most right now. Check out all the merch at votelikeamother.org. You can also donate directly by going to feedamerica.org. And you can find direct links in the show notes on the app that you're listening on right now. Let me know what you thought of this topic and conversation. You can always reach me at my new email address, jeremy@highway2.health. And stay tuned for our new and expanded website coming soon, highway2.health. Thanks for listening and for all that you do. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.